You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This episode is for October 1st, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. The show this week is a compilation of the best of the SGU 24 show, which aired on September 23rd and 24th. We did 24 hours of live audio and video streaming. Most of that will be made available separately. However, the show this week is comprised of selective segments from the 24-hour show. So enjoy. Well, here we are, guys.
Yeah.
You're probably wondering why I called you all to the Skepta Lair.
I'm sorry, the what?
The Skepta Lair?
I thought we agreed to never call it that.
You agreed.
Yeah, I decided, and you all agreed.
Now, you decided we all ignored you. So, the Skepta Lair. Nice upgrades, Jay, by the way. I like it. The reason I called you all together is because of the Skeptometer over there. You can see that it's getting dangerously close to the red.
Oh.
Is everything just going to have Skepta in front of it for the rest of the show? Is that the
Skepta
way?
Right. Skeptalutely.
How's your Skepta Coke?
It's Skeptalicious.
Skeptalicious. So, you know that in the red is a total gullible worldwide meltdown. We're still in the orange, but we're getting awfully close to the red. Orange is relative state of gullibility, scientific illiteracy in the world, which we've been sort of wallowing in for a while, but now we're almost ready to tip over into gullible, scientifically illiterate meltdown. So right. I decided that we need 24 hours or thereabouts of continuous science education and skepticism. We'll work our way around the globe, talking to skeptics and scientists around the world to try to push the meter back at least somewhat closer to the yellow.
24 hours. Steve.
Evan, you have a This Day in Skepticism. Oh, I'm sorry. I have to come over here to my console to pull up This Day in Skepticism. Let's see. What do we got here?
Keyboard. How quaint.
Remember that?
Evan, what are we looking
right.
at here?
All right. Yeah. Planet Neptune. 5 hours. Yeah. Is everyone familiar with the planet Neptune?
Planet Neptune.
Is everyone aware that on September 23rd in 1846, the German astronomer Johann Galle discovered Neptune? After only an hour of searching for it.
Wow.
He found it within 1 degree of the position that had been computed by Urbain Jean-Joseph Le Verrier, based on his calculations.
Le Verrier or Le Verrier?
Le Verrier. That's
sure?
how I'm saying it.
Rhymes with Derriere.
That reminds me of
Derriere. I'm American.
So when we were at DragonCon a few weeks ago,
yeah.
for the first time in my life, I heard somebody say the word Perrier
instead
of Perrier.
See? Mm-hmm.
And I figured, okay, this is just a Southern thing.
Nope.
But then last week, I was at a restaurant right here in New England, and the waitress, I ordered a sparkling water, and she said, well, we have Perrier.
Not in cultured New England.
No.
Oh, no.
What are the
what
odds?
Is the world coming to?
Why the hell stick an R on the end of your word if you don't want it pronounced?
So, Le Verrier.
Le Verrier.
Have you ever heard someone mispronounce something, and you actually go, am I saying it wrong?
Oh, all the time.
I do that. I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I never do it.
It's actually considered one of the best-known events in the history of science.
Mm-hmm.
According to a gentleman named Hubble and Smith from the Smithsonian, then Johns Hopkins University, who reported extensively about this particular discovery. So, it was mathematically predicted before it was directly observed, as I had said. It was a big, big deal in 19th century astronomy, right? I mean, here you have, you know, prediction coming true based on scientific analysis, and they found it exactly pretty much where they said it would. And it
science was works, bitches.
A confirmation of Newtonian gravitational theory.
When you think about it, and I often use this as an example or just the fact that, you know, people say, well, how do we know that science works? Or they try to get all philosophical and say, well, science can't prove itself, or it's all based upon assumptions. Yeah, but you know, Le Verrier said, produced scientific principles to predict where a planet would be, and lo and behold, there it was.
Mm-hmm.
And further, we use the same principles, the notions of our gravitation, even now relativity, etc., in order to send a little hunk of metal, you know, all the way, you know, halfway across the solar system. And if science didn't work, if it wasn't a accurate portrayal of reality, at least theoretically, we wouldn't have gotten back nice pictures of Jupiter and Saturn. You know, it wouldn't have worked. But it did work. It was more powerful than any other way of trying to understand the universe. And that still is my favorite example of like the meta experiment of science. It works.
It would be a footnote in history. People are like, oh yeah, remember they tried science a few centuries ago?
Yeah, right.
Isn't that silly? Imagine that.
Yeah. That didn't work out too well. Right?
Yeah, right. But and there'd be some fringe science practitioners, and we'd be like critiquing them.
Maybe there'd be like a technorati, a hidden group of people behind the scenes, like totally.
So NASA launched the twin craft, the Grail crafts, A and B, to the moon. They launched pretty recently. When was that? September 10th. To study the moon in unprecedented detail. Are you guys aware of this?
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're going much slower than the Apollo rockets. The Apollo rockets were going to get to the moon in 3 days. These are going to take a much longer amount of time because they're not going nearly as fast.
And did they send them all, like, to Mars to get a gravity-assisted Mars and then around the sun and then to Jupiter and then to the moon, right? Is that how they work it usually?
They're going to get there in 3.5 months.
Really?
Yep. That's like 30 times how long.
Oh, I figured 2 weeks.
Yeah.
3.5 months.
That's crazy.
It's a low energy trajectory, I guess. Well, the thing about the Apollo missions is that they had to get there quickly. So they had to build a massive rocket with a lot of fuel that could get to the moon in a few days because they didn't want the astronauts to be out there. They wouldn't survive for 3 months with all the radiation and everything, right? We talk about this in terms of going to Mars.
Yeah.
But this is just a probe, so it doesn't matter if it takes 3.5 months to get there. So they save a lot of fuel.
Yeah,
it's obviously a much smaller rocket.
I'm glad you said that because I thought it was so strange. 3 months versus 3 days. I mean, that's a massive speed difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what's it going to do there?
As Bob said, it's going to map the interior of the moon to understand better how it evolved. Pretty cool.
Australopithecus sediba.
Wow.
So this is a discovery of a specimen of an early hominid in the Australopithecus genus, specifically Australopithecus sediba. And Australopithecus came just before Homo, right, the genus Homo. And this is being described as a quote-unquote game changer, meaning that it's fundamentally changing the way we draw the early family tree, right?
I look at it like having a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces, but we only have a few pieces here and there, and we're trying to figure out what the whole complicated picture is based upon those few pieces. And so every time we find a piece of the puzzle with a nice juicy bit of information, it changes, how we connect everything up. Of course, the media always likes to convey that with
evolution was wrong.
Much hyperbole as possible. It's like, this changes everything we thought we knew about human evolution. It's like, no.
Creationists are all about moving the goalposts.
Yeah. And oftentimes this involves, because part of what we're doing when we are trying to, reconstruct these evolutionary trees, which is really like branching bushes, is to decide when features evolved, when they developed, right? And then which species are descendants because they also share that feature. So these are so-called homologous features. But of course, this is always based upon incomplete information so that, the earliest example of a feature is just whatever the earliest fossil we have that is displaying that feature. But it's almost certainly not the actual earliest individual creature, maybe even species or population that had that feature. So the chances are, the first fossil we discover that with that feature wasn't the first instance of that feature arising in evolutionary history. It's a random scatter of evidence. So over time, we expect that we're going to be pushing back the timeline, like pushing back the earliest instance of whatever, of a species, of a feature, of a group. So that's what's happening here. And specifically, and this is always the one that I think forces the most change in the way we draw the lines, and that is where we find an example, a specimen that has features that we attribute to that are primitive, meaning that they are typical of an earlier group, but also has features that are very advanced in that they are features of a later group. So it's moving back our timeline in terms of when that feature first arose in evolution. And it also helps us decide, in which group did that feature originally occur. So in this case, essentially what we found is a specimen of Australopithecus sediba who has features. So this is Australopithecus. This is before the development of the
the Homo genus, with Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo sapiens. So those were creatures that were clearly close to humans. And while some, like the Neanderthals may be a side branch, but like, you know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus were clearly on the path to becoming humans. Australopithecines were earlier, and they were branching in many different directions. Only one branch from the Australopithecine group led to the later...
The Homo.
Yeah, the Homo line, the later human line. Mm. So what we have an Australopithecus sediba, which is an old specimen with primitive findings, you know, typical of Australopithecines, but with other specific morphological features that we previously only saw in the Homo line, which indicates that maybe that's the one branch of the Australopithecines that in fact led to the Homo habilis erectus.
The non-missing link.
Yeah, so, because you know, there's Australopithecus africanus and afarensis and robustus, right, and boisier. There's like all different, you know, there's been an increasing number of Australopithecine species that we've been discovering. And this might be an indication that sediba was the one that led to the human branch.
You don't hear about sediba much, right? It's
not as often mentioned. It was unknown of when I was in college, when I first took like a really thorough course on human evolution, and it was discovered, you know, sometime in the last decade or so. Wow. Yeah, the bones that they're talking about now were actually found in 2008, which is typical. It takes a few years to really reconstruct and fully analyze fossils. So oftentimes when a fossil is making this kind of headlines, it probably was discovered years earlier. We saw that with the Darwinius maceli. Remember that?
Yeah.
That
was really, how could we possibly forget?
Yeah, that was making a big splash, but the bones had actually been found a few years earlier, it took a few years to analyze it completely. So this is interesting, but you know, that just it's more interest in what it means for a fossil to have this kind of impact rather than what this specific impact of this fossil is. So the researchers say that, you know, the brain of sediba is small like a chimpanzee, but in the configuration, particularly with the expansion of parts of the brain behind the eye, that looks more human than other Australopithecines do. Of course, you always have to be worried that the feature that you're looking at is analogous instead of homologous, right? In other words,
of course,
that it just happens to look like the feature that in question, rather than actually being evolved and being an evolutionary ancestor to there isn't an evolutionary relationship, which is homologous, but just a morphological relationship because of
similar environment,
or just coincidence. We're still at the point where every really nice specimen tells us something new about how to draw the family tree, you know, the hominid line. So it's interesting. This one is yours, Rebecca. Coming to terms with the female orgasm.
Yeah, there was a study that was just published and got a lot of media attention because it had the word orgasm somewhere in the title.
That'll do it.
And yeah, and so of course there were a lot of bad science articles written about it. And luckily there were a number of skeptics around who understood the study a lot better than the science writers, and even a lot better than apparently the people who conducted the study and were able to tear it apart. So two researchers were studying, they were attempting to find out whether or not the female orgasm is an adaptive trait. They had this theory that it is not adaptive. I believe they were attempting to disprove that theory. And they thought that they did. Basically, their conclusion was that they were unable to prove that the female orgasm is a non-adaptive trait. And the way they went about doing it was to study twins. And we've talked in the past about the problems with twin studies. And in this, those problems were multiplied. And I think we've even talked about the problem with twin studies in relation to orgasm studies. I'm pretty sure. Oh, I think it was the search for the G-spot.
Yes.
There was a study on the G spot that used twins. It was just not well done.
But there was also, we talked about that with Terrence Hines, because he had a very simple hypothesis. He said if the G spot is real, then there should be some anatomical correlate to that. There should be some places in the vaginal wall that have an increased density of neurons. Studies looking at the histology, the microscopic anatomy of the neuron density in the vaginal walls have never shown that, and therefore maybe the G-spot is a cultural belief or an illusion, not a real physiological thing. And that's still that's a reasonable line of scientific thinking. However, it's not conclusive in and of itself that there is not a G-spot, because there could be a neurological cause that does not relate to just neuronal or nerve ending density, right? Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, it was discovered that there are certain nerve endings in the vaginal wall that behave differently than other neurons, that they're pacer neurons, basically, that they can actually generate more activity. And therefore, there may have been that rescues the notion of a G-spot, because you have nerve endings and sensory neurons which maybe are more reactive and can drive other neurons, even though they don't occur in a greater density, they can have a more robust function.
Right. Yeah, that was a good little aside on the G-spot. All right,
that help you out there? Are you good?
I phased out. Okay. It was good.
So this is a different study.
But it is also one that studies twins. The idea being that you look at twins and you study their sexual behavior, and you look at whether or not there's a correlation between twins sharing similar reports of experiencing orgasm. And they studied both men and women, and what they found was that they were unable to see many similarities between twins. They weren't seeing twins who both experienced the same level of orgasm in women.
In other words, characteristics of having an orgasm in women does not track with twins, then therefore it's not genetic, and therefore it's not adaptive. I think that was their line of reasoning.
Right. There was no correlation.
Yeah.
Between different sex siblings. So yeah, that's where they went with it. But there were just a ton of problems with the study. First of all, I mean, twin studies can be good, but in this case, we're talking about something that can have, there are a lot of things you can go through in your life that will influence whether or not you will come to orgasm during sexual intercourse. And there's a huge social component to it, and that's been shown in various studies. For instance, it's even shown in this study. I think it was P.Z. Myers pointed out that in this study, which was done on a very specific sample group of Finns, I believe, they said that 12% of the women reported rarely or never having an orgasm in the last 4 weeks, which is a really good number compared to previous figures we've seen. So yeah, there's a huge difference between what they found. They found that this very low percentage of women reporting no orgasm compared to previous studies that have shown in larger samples that there's a much higher percentage of women who can experience orgasm. So we're seeing that maybe this select group of women are orgasming more often, and maybe that has a very strong social component to it, because the male subjects who reported never achieving orgasm through intercourse, that percentage matched the larger group. So the female orgasm was much more reliant on possibly on social issues, and it's not just something that you can study twins on and say, well, that twin orgasms, that twin doesn't. Therefore, I mean it. Those twins have led very different lives since they were born. And that can have a huge impact on whether or not they will come to orgasm. So there's that. There's also the fact that, again, PZ pointed out, that they were comparing men and women, but the two groups were asked completely different questions. Men were asked, how fast have you typically ejaculated after the intercourse, vaginal or anal, has commenced? And women were asked, over the past 4 weeks, when you had sexual stimulation or intercourse, how often did you reach orgasm? Which you can't do. If you want to compare two groups, you can't ask them.
Yeah.
Those are completely different questions. Right. And you can't then take the data and compare them. So there were a lot of problems with this, and a lot of other bloggers have rightfully criticized it. Yeah. Greg Layden had a really good post that PZ actually takes issue with, because Greg has a problem with the whole idea of assuming that just because an orgasm doesn't directly lead to fertilization, that it therefore must not be adaptive.
Yeah.
He thinks that the researchers are coming at it from a completely different, like the completely wrong perspective, right, in the first place. And Cy Curious also wrote a really good article tearing this
Cy Curious
paper to...
It's a good title.
Yeah, tearing the paper apart.
Yeah, the adaptation, again, is one of those things I'm really interested in, it's, because when I... like really start to seriously study evolutionary theory, which is, you know, it's one of the my favorite things in science to study just for fun, because, you know, if I think back like 30 years, my understanding of it was plagued with misconceptions, with oversimplifications, et cetera. And then the more I learned about it, just it seems like there's always these more and more, you know, deep, fascinating ideas. Our understanding of, you know, conceptually of how evolution works now is so much deeper than it was, and so you individually you can embark on that same journey, you know, as that scientist did. So anyway, one of the things is really thinking deeply about the very question of adaptation, and I think people maybe start from a hyper adaptationalist point of view where everything has a very specific function and a specific advantage. But in fact, it's much more complicated than that. There can be many indirect advantages to something. And not just like there's so-called sexual selection, where a trait may not be advantageous directly to your survival. But if the other sex has a preference for that trait, then it becomes sexually selected. For orgasms, I mean, I'll just... My understanding, like my textbook understanding of the difference between men and women... kind of makes sense from a fertilization point of view, and that is that men, and this is like well established science, they definitely reach more of a very specific peak with orgasm, and then they go into a refractory period where they're actually immune to erotic stimulation, right? They don't respond at all to anything sexual.
Refractory, is that what they call it?
It's a refractory period. There's actually,
you can use
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Whereas women are...
I'm out.
Women don't have that. They don't have a refractory period. So they are more receptive and interested for a longer period of time. And if they have an orgasm, they're still responsive to erotic stimuli. Even after that, they're still ready to go. So that kind of makes sense. I mean, if primary evolutionary advantage to sex is reproducing, you know, that goal is not accomplished until the male has the ejaculation. So... both the way both sexes respond to sex kind of fits that. That doesn't mean that women enjoying it or being interested in it or having orgasms is not an adaptation, just because that's not the primary goal of reproduction. It also, I think, does come from somewhat of a male-dominated and naive, and now I think by the knowledge that we have, incorrect view that men are dominant when it comes to sex, in that, you know, it's all up to what they want and what they decide, when in fact we realize that women have a lot of power when it comes to that. And this is not just in humans, this is also in animals. You know, like female primates actually choose characteristics of the males, and that there wouldn't be that male sexual selection if the females weren't doing the choosing, meaning they weren't in control of the mating, right?
I completely agree with what you say about enjoying how new discoveries sort of open up the breadth of the topic and
change your way of thinking about it.
Yeah, and that's what I really liked about this. I'm glad that this paper came out, because even though it was a terrible study,
I think it can be really educational to see different people in different fields sort of breaking it down. And I know it didn't come across in this segment, but I learned a lot through reading, you know, particularly PZ's and Greg Layden's. I really enjoyed seeing their alternate and at times conflicting takes on
it.
But it does go to show you how, as Ben Goldacre says, I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, right.
I really enjoyed that.
The special report on siphonomores. You were going to tell us about siphonomores.
Siphonophores,
Siphonophores.
After a while, after doing research and looking at all these news items, and you know, you think you've seen everything, all the wonders of evolution, and then I don't know, I just never heard of these colony creatures before. And seeing my first one on that YouTube video was really an eye opener, and it's just so fascinating and otherworldly. If you could imagine taking a bunch of jellies, you know, a bunch of jellyfish, and putting them together with some snakes and mashing them all together and having them like float around waving their tentacles. I mean, it really looked like it could have evolved on Europa or some other planet. Right. It just didn't. I had never seen one or heard of one. So I did a little research about it and kind of slaked my curiosity about it. And I've always meant to talk about it a little bit and show what these things look like, or at least some of them, because there's lots of different species. So the idea, though, is that they're colony creatures, and it's not just like ants or bees. These guys are different. It depends how you look at them, and it actually depends on what kind of specialist you talk to. But they're composed of parts of separate animals that have become so physiologically integrated that they're now essentially one organism. So for a lot of these colony creatures, siphonophores, they become so specialized that you've got basically, and they're, I think these little entities, these little individuals, are called zoonoids, and some of them are so specialized that they might consist of just a mouth with not even really even a digestive system, and they kind of like, they act like one creature, but they're actually composed of individual creatures that have been super specialized. Now, some of the specialists that really know this stuff, they actually disagree. They're not sure, you know, are these individuals that are integrated together, or is it just one big individual? And they can't even agree. So it's really an interesting thought experiment on what an individual is and what it isn't. So one example that you may have heard of is Portuguese man of war. They're a siphonophore. Yeah. There's so many dramatic examples.
Really? Jelly?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought they were a
surprising.
Jelly.
They're siphonophore, and I mean they're related. Siphonophores they're related to coral and true jellies.
Yeah. Okay.
But
Bob, in your reading, so again, getting back to the evolutionary question,
right?
Were colony creatures like this possibly a stepping stone from single cell to multicellular?
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. There's lots of unknowns about that, but I think this is definitely possible, and it makes a lot of sense. And the other key thing, though, is that these individuals don't come together. They're actually born this way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're born from one...
Like Lady Gaga.
Yeah, so they are marvelous, and that is perhaps the way, or one of the ways, they...
Are we seeing
to multicellular?
Yeah, are we seeing yet another stage? So you might have like a single-celled animal, then you have a colony of single cells that then specialize to such a degree that they become multicellular.
Exactly.
But then you have a colony of multicellular animals.
Whoa.
And then they
become a
meta-organism that is eventually specialized to the point of view that it's still one organism, but... its individual components are multicellular animals. Is that what these are, or and could that lead to something that's even like that order one level higher than just a multicellular creature?
I think that's something that humans might do. Imagine merging personalities, and I mean we might transcend beyond normal biology at that point, but still the idea holds where you're taking individuals and merging them, and then merging that. To a certain extent, but yeah, who knows? I mean, given enough time, there's so much that I would not be surprised with. But
And bees are a little bit like that. I mean, in that it's a colony creature that is individualized. Like, so some bees can't reproduce, and their evolutionary success depends upon other versions of their
right.
species, you know, reproducing, and they carry out their evolutionary success.
It's like a precarious way to kind of go about evolving into the future.
No, but it works. It works. It's fine.
But don't forget, though, I mean, a lot of these individual zoonoids, and I guess Medusae or some of the other ones, they can't really live on their own. You know, you separate them, and they're, you know, they're in big, big trouble, whereas bees would last, you know, an individual bee would last for a while. So yeah, this is taking that idea to an extraordinary level. I mean, some of them are just so pared down that they're like a stomach or a mouth or eyes type of thing, where it's just amazing to think that they become so specialized and integrated that they never could survive on their own. They also, because of their nature, these are among the biggest and longest creatures in the world. I mean, you know, well over 100 feet long, a lot of them, but very, very tenuous, very, very fragile. Some of them, a lot of them, you just give them a little bump and they would break apart. So they're very fragile. And if you're living in the sea, of course, you don't need to be necessarily really hardy because it's you can just float around. But a lot of them just rip apart when you try to net them and stuff. But look them up on YouTube. Check them out. They're fascinating.
All right. So we're going to do a top 10 list.
Which one do you want to do?
I want to do the top 10 future sci-fi technologies you wish you could have today.
All right, well, I want to tell you, when I started my list, the first thing I thought of course, was Bob, because Bob and I literally have this conversation all the time, especially if one of us has thought of something that we've never thought of before, which doesn't happen in this category that often. But the thing I don't like about thinking about future technology is once you hit like the singularity concept, mm-hmm. once you're like, oh, well, if we have like full-blown nanotechnology or full-blown femtotechnology, then we're done. Then you can't, there's nothing to fantasize about anymore, because you can achieve pretty much anything that you could do in the physical world. It's the end. That's like the last door. Wait, I'm not finished.
But let the man finish.
We should talk about things that we think we could have, like, let's say things that we could have like in 50 years worth of technology, like things that like we do today, like the iPhone came along or the smartphone came along and that was epic.
Yeah.
You know, the internet came along. That was epic. Let's talk about stuff. I'm sure you guys came up with both, but I think it would be great to talk about stuff that are life changers, but not like I can imagine to, you know, I want to
Short of the end stage.
Yeah.
Okay. Short of the end stage.
I'm trying to spread it out. It's 24 hours, Steve.
As things come online, what are the ones that you anticipate the most? And you could even, it's a top 10 list. You could start at 10 being like, I want the iPad 3. That's what I'm really waiting for. But then you can work your way up to number one, which would be mature. My number one is mature nanotechnology-based immortality. That's my number one future technology wish.
Boring.
Right? Because once you got that, you could pretty much wait for anything else.
My number one is a hoverboard, like in Back to the Future.
Yes. But see, if I had mature nanotechnology-based immortality, I will live long enough to get the hoverboard.
Maybe not. Maybe that won't be something that marketers are interested in producing.
Well, what else you got?
I also have a TARDIS that's shaped like a DeLorean, because I want a time machine. I can really decide which one, like the DeLorean looks better, but the TARDIS has more room on the inside, so it's a bit more comfortable. So I was thinking a TARDIS with a chameleon circuit that will allow it to appear as a DeLorean.
That's fine. I was thinking of a DeLorean shaped like a TARDIS.
That doesn't, that makes, no, just shut up. That doesn't make sense.
All right. Well, my low down on my list, meaning that it was something that I think would have a huge impact, and is something that we might actually see to some degree, is optimized solar-based energy or photovoltaics. Mm-hmm. I mean, some kind of breakthrough that gives us reasonably high efficiency in terms of the percentage of solar energy that it converts to electricity. That it does, that it's cheap, durable, low maintenance. You know, the point, once we get to the point where basically we can coat everything with these photovoltaics, because that will generate tons of energy that's both clean and renewable. The one downside that solar technology itself will not solve is storing the energy. And it also, because you would need to store it because there's no sunshine at night, right? So but in fact, the peak energy use is in the evening when there isn't light.
Yeah.
So you would, by itself, it really, you would either need to have it like in outer space where you could beam it down to Earth whenever you want, or you'd need some also an advance in energy storage or battery technology to really get the most out of it. But even without that, just imagine how much of our energy we would be able to supplant with mature solar technology.
I mean, yeah, that's the key, though. Mature solar technology would easily be able to do that. I read figures about coating. If we just coated all the roads in the United States with solar cells, very efficient solar cells, it would create a huge, huge amount of electricity that we could tap into, and that's just the roads. I really like the idea of the space-based solar collectors because it gets rid of that whole nighttime problem.
Nighttime.
And they could also beam the energy down in like microwaves that you could walk through, and it really wouldn't be a problem. It's not like you're going to get microwaved to death if you accidentally walk through these microwave beams. So
why not?
But the thing is, because the energy per unit area is so diffuse that it's not like you're going to,
will it give you a little tingle
inside?
Get a 3D.
Yeah, but that's a hell of an engineering project. I mean, imagine the size of the satellite you would need to collect enough solar energy.
About 100?
But there are like some really great short-term things. I'm sure I've talked about this before, but the fact that there are some people who are working on this idea of being able to send just a bag of stuff to someone in a developing country with one sheet of information for how they can take local ingredients and combine them to make their own solar panel that can... regardless of storage capacity, can help them run, for instance, like a small laptop or something like that.
Well, we have those now. A guy I work with went hiking, and he had a solar pack, right? It was like a little piece of, like a rolled out. He had it on his backpack, and then he had his iPhone plugged into it, and it charged his iPhone all day, and he had at least could power a couple of devices off.
Yeah, well, the difference, I think, is that this is something that relies upon organic materials that are easily found around people in developing countries. And so that way, you reduce your total costs. Like, there's nothing you have to build first. Mm-hmm. And all you have is a small bag of stuff. And then the person on the ground in the other country can assemble it and have their own working solar panel. So it's a little different, but, I'm sure the same sort of technology.
Send the right language instructions.
All right, so we're all down with the whole solar technology.
Yeah, what else? What else you guys got?
Wireless power.
It's coming. It's coming.
I know it's coming, but,
He wants it today.
Today. I think the big problem with it now, as it's manifested now, is the inefficiency. It just takes so much of it to do a little bit of work. But that would be, obviously, that would be great. I'm just so sick of these wires and these cords.
Tell me about it.
Just so annoying. If they could really nail that, that'd be fantastic.
Right.
All right, well, I got one. Remember when they were saying it's going to be a one-hour space flight ride to any point on the planet?
Yeah.
Remember 45
minutes.
They were the gravity train.
Yeah, well, this thing was, if I remember correctly, they were saying it's going to be a plane takes off.
Oh.
It's a space plane.
Yeah.
Right. It peaks and it comes down and it can take you anywhere in an hour.
Like a scramjet, like a really mature scramjet.
Especially after doing the trip to Australia. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't as horrific as I thought it was going to be. But, I did it, and now I'm like, I don't know if I ever want to do that again. So the one-hour thing would be awesome.
That would be nice. I have two things on my list that are along those lines. One is just teleportation.
Yeah.
Well,
walk through.
I'll give it up. Don't even. Why would you say that? Why would you even?
Because.
It's sci-fi. Future.
But regardless, I would rather have space plane or gravity train than teleportation. Until maybe we move on to other planets, then
you're worried
okay.
about the continuity.
Yeah, what about continuity?
Yeah, like I'm dead. If you're talking about taking whatever and rebuilding, then yeah, I mean it's a little silly, but
not all people agree with
it's
us,
not.
Rebecca.
But what if the teleportation did not involve destroying you and recreating you, but it actually physically moved you intact through some kind of a wormhole.
Yeah. Great. I'm all for wormholes.
That's
all right, so wormholes are great.
Think about
that's
how
fun.
Childbirth would be, right? You could just teleport the baby right out. How great would... I mean, really.
They actually did that.
We're talking about.
They actually did that in Star Trek.
I don't.
Did they?
I didn't know that, Voyager.
They tried to deliver the baby conventionally.
Was that when Janeway turned into a lizard and Tom Paris got her pregnant?
Oh boy, I don't remember.
Are you kidding? That's only the best episode of Star Trek ever made. They turn lizards and they mate and then they have babies. It's terrible. It's one of the worst hours
of
television.
You take that to the next level, and without even having to use teleportation technology, you just have the baby grow outside of the mother's womb and not have no delivery. Just have it grow.
Exogenesis, which would be great because the baby, assuming the pod or whatever the technology is advanced enough, it'd be fantastic because the baby would get exactly what it needs when it needs it, and you wouldn't have to worry about the mother, you know, not having a good diet, smoking, drinking. I mean, yeah, the mom could do whatever she wants.
No, I mean, that would be
have no as, impact.
That would be as big for, I think, women, like equality of the genders, right, as birth control was. You know,
we're really heading there.
You could get pregnant, not worry about losing your job from taking off the time. You know,
yeah,
things like
right.
that. That'd be huge.
I think we'll definitely get there. Who knows when? But if you track when we've been able to, you know, take an unborn baby and make it viable, you know, viability has been creeping down. You know, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months. Eventually, it'll be 0 months, and you'll be able to take a zygote and grow it in an optimal environment, and that would be pretty fantastic.
The only tricky thing I think would be hormones, because there are a lot of things with, you know, bonding between a mother and a child that's growing, you know, and obviously
just
people
get your oxytocin shots.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there would be a way to
right, and of course there'll be those little Luddites who say, well, that ain't natural, and they'll come up with, you don't bond,
just like C-sections weren't natural.
Yeah. All right, I got another one.
Wait, the second thing that would trump the teleportation or the jet is, how about just a personal flying car? And I mean, like a real, you get into it and you could go supersonic speeds or on the roads as fast as you want. You could tell the computer to take you somewhere. Just like really optimized, fast, convenient, safe, personal transportation.
Yeah, I had on my list driverless car, so sure. Yeah. You one up it. You can have a driverless flying car.
Driverless flying car.
Okay, yeah. I'm totally with you on that.
Right.
All right, I got another one. This is not that sexy or romantic, but smart home technology that integrates everything.
All right, I upped you again.
What? Super smart home technology.
I love that.
Sol 9000 technology.
A programmable house.
All right.
What I want to be able to do is like have a computer like my laptop and plug it into a big puddle of gray ooze and then design my house and have the ooze assemble itself into my house down to every detail. Of course, it'll be self-repairing, and I can alter it at will. I could, like, literally walk through the house with my iPad equivalent, moving walls around, having furniture appear, changing the color of the walls, literally program at will, as if it were virtual, the physical three-dimensional environment.
What you're talking about is foglet technology, and that was actually on my list, and that's really probably the ultimate manifestation of a nanotech or programmable environment. They're really amazing. The idea is really amazing, and I think eventually it's going to be fairly inevitable. The idea was that you've got this little cell-sized nanite or whatever you want to call it with these extendable arms, and they all kind of hook together. So they're all connected together, and they could actually – it's telescoping. So they can get small. They can get big. They could even change – what color they are, what the texture is. So essentially, your whole house is made out of these foglets. And like Steve said, you could actually do whatever the hell you want with the house. You could change rooms, move walls, change textures. And actually, these foglets can actually even exist in the air. I mean, you could actually breathe. I mean, part of the atmosphere.
Now you're getting crazy.
Could be consistent with them. But no, the interesting thing. No, I mean, you want to extrapolate this, Steve. The really cool thing that you could do is because these foglets are everywhere in your environment. It actually knows exactly where you are, how you're oriented, and everything about it. You could kind of use that idea to communicate with somebody on the other side of the planet, because they would have their little foglet house, and the foglets would be able to build a duplicate of that person, and it would be like Jay and I. I mean, Jay could be in Australia right now, but he's really a foglet recreation, and I'm talking to him, and it'd be indistinguishable. And then, of course, that leads to the idea of what if you were made out of foglets? What if human beings
change themselves in such a way that they are all these
little
foglet
things. Yeah, we already talked about this. I think it's really awesome. It seems really far away, though. How about something, about sense enhancers?
I've got actually one similar to that.
Everybody is like,
Go on. You want to finish it? No, it's not a one-up. It's actually, it's slightly over here to that.
So it's not a one-up, it's more of an aside.
It's an aside. So why don't you go on?
So I'm just thinking, like, you know, you just plug these earplugs in and you could hear much better, you know, evens out everything so you don't ever get blasted or, you know, protect your ears, but it'll also let you hear things far away or hear more tonal quality and things or whatever.
Cybernetic eyeballs.
Contact lenses that let you see colors that we can't see. Not that we can't see, but it'll show you visible light in that will replace light that we can't see, so you could just have a bigger spectrum of things that you could see. And also, you know, you could put things in your nose, maybe enhance your smell somehow or whatever. And with that, augmented reality. You guys know what Bob, I know Bob.
Yes. Yeah.
But augmented reality would be a thing. Like, let's say you're wearing these contact lenses, and you could be a car mechanic, and it'll show you a 3D rendering of the engine that you're looking at. So you get your hands in there, and it'll be like, well, this pipe connects all the way to this, and it'll show you things that you're actually not visible to you. And augmented reality is not... you know, is not that far off. I mean, we could actually be playing with that stuff within the next decade or so.
Well, they've actually got applications for your iPhone where, you know, you turn your camera on and you overlay it over something and you look at it and it'll say, oh, that restaurant is whatever. Or, they're pretty lame as it is right now, but the potential, I agree with Jay, the potential is amazing for that kind of stuff. I mean, just for teaching and diagnostics and just for information to have all these computer screens that we have, are really, a lot of these are going to go away because... this virtual reality will be overlaid on real reality. I mean, you're just putting on glasses or contacts, like Jay said. I'm really looking forward to that, and it should be here by now. What's taking so long? I mean, it's not
What the hell?
I'd say within 10 years that it's really going to be going
crazy.
Yeah,
10 years ago. I think that along those lines, my number two is actually fully realized virtual reality. So the kind of virtual reality that is indistinguishable from real reality.
Oh, that's great.
But to any world you want, you can have any abilities or any power. Like a holodeck. Even better than... Well, a holodeck is you are physically in the holodeck.
Yeah.
But a virtual reality is you're, you know, whatever. You're just laying in bed with the... Yeah. Whatever, jacked in or whatever. It probably would have to be, which is one of my other ones, a computer neural interface. Mm-hmm. But it would be difficult to get the really 100% realistic experience just from like goggles and gloves and stuff like that. The only downside is when it's possible to give you a virtual experience that's indistinguishable from reality.
Game over.
How could you ever? That's you're thinking of a different downside. My worst downside is how could you ever know from that point forward that you're in reality and not in a virtual world?
Yeah, but at that point, who cares?
You could make that argument. Who cares?
You could have a secret word with someone.
You can have a totem.
Yeah, you need the totem. Inception.
Yeah, well, it's like Inception. Right? How deep do you get? Does it really?
How deep do you get? And do you ever get out? How would you know?
Yes.
Well, that's
But Bob was saying though, you were talking about the fact that that would be the most addictive drug that.
Oh right. Yeah. Construct your own reality. The only problem.
Why would you ever come back to the reality?
Well, the only problem with dealing with your messy biology and making sure it's taken care of and. You know,
well, that's for someone else to do.
Yeah, if you got a lot of money and can do that, that's fine. But I like the idea of these levels to reality, and you never know when the last one is. We talked about that a little while ago. It's funny though, because if you think that we might be a simulation on some supercomputer, and the guy running that computer could also be a simulation, it's funny though. Some scenarios I read described it as the simulation breaks down once you reach a singularity level of technology because the computer can't simulate it sufficiently well. So it's funny, if we actually create a singularity and our simulation ends because it's just too CPU expensive to run it, and the reality ends because we got too advanced, it'd be kind of ironic.
I want to throw in a babblefish because it's on my list, and a few people on Twitter have asked why we haven't mentioned it. That is totally one of the things that I want. A babblefish. Yeah, from Hitchhiker's Guide. Stick it in your ear.
Why can't everyone just learn how to speak English?
Or Esperanto.
Well, right. Hey, you know what? I'll make you a deal. If everyone in the world learns Esperanto, I will learn it.
Yeah.
What does
it'll
it sound like? I've never heard Esperanto.
Like Spanish.
Go to
right?
YouTube. Look up some Esperanto.
Isn't it like
people.
I don't think
a
it sounds like
language?
I think it's Latin-based.
Yeah.
All right, I got a couple more for you guys. I want an AI assistant.
I'll one up that.
Yeah.
Right. So you have you can have an assistant. You could be wearing it. It could be like on your watch. The other thing is so I'm saying about the artificial intelligence, but it would be cool to have a real robot. I think we're gonna create machines that we become friends with.
Sure.
You know? Oh, absolutely.
We already have.
People be falling in love with these damn things before long.
How about this is my last one on the list, a starship. All the technology necessary to actually travel to other solar systems, really like explore the actual galaxy.
Yeah, and I could physically go there. That's on my list as well. My example was it's an Enterprise, but it's the Enterprise NCC-1701J, which actually appeared in one episode of the Enterprise series. This came from like the 27th century, I think. And I think it was one of the most advanced Enterprises ever shown. Even if it was for just a brief amount of time, this thing actually could travel to other galaxies, which no other starship in Star Trek or no other Enterprise was able to do. It actually folded space to move very quickly from one galaxy to another. Of course, that's really silly because the energy required to bend space would require, you have to use all the energy available in space essentially to do that. But it was really an interesting ship. They had universities and libraries and, I mean, it was so big, Steve. I think it's like 2 miles long. It was so big that they didn't have turbo lifts anymore. They used site-to-site transporters in this brief description that we got of the ship. So I would pick that ship as an example of that, of a starship that I would just love to have.
Look who it is.
Hey, it's everyone.
Hey, that's Joe and Dr. Rachie and some handsome guy on the right. My three favorite Australians.
And, there's Mr. Nomington. Skeptical Wombat.
Hello, Skeptics Guide to the Universe. You poor people. It's a wonderful afternoon here in Sydney, although it's raining and cold. At least it's daytime.
So why don't we, for the sake of our listeners who aren't as familiar with the Australian skeptics as they should be, why don't you guys each introduce yourselves?
I'm Richard Saunders. I'm a vice president of Australian Skeptics and the host and producer of the Skeptic Zone podcast, skepticzone.tv.
I'm Dr. Rachel Dunlop. I'm also a vice president of Australian Skeptics. We're all part of the Skeptic Zone podcast as well.
Hi, I'm Jo Benhamou, and I'm a committee member of the Australian Skeptics and an occasional contributor to the Skeptic Zone podcast, and I'm a nurse. I'm a registered nurse.
Awesome. How about that?
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's really difficult because it's 3 in the morning. Oh, right now.
Yeah, it's not, Rebecca. It's 5 in the afternoon.
Yes, it's a great time. We're well rested.
Yeah, well, we're really happy to have you guys on. And, the Australian skeptics, I think, are really well known for getting things done. So
for kicking ass.
What's your most recent success stories? What's going on?
Well, I guess in the public imagination now, recent successes would be around the power balance, the magical wristband.
Someone suggested that our power balance weren't working because of our technical problems earlier in the evening. So maybe it was
you see.
Yeah.
Now, I have a real one here somewhere. These are the placebo bands that we're all wearing from our good friends at skepticalbros.com. And they were set up to show that the so-called real power balance bands were rubbish. That's a real one. That's actually from Japan. But when they sold them here in Australia, they were selling these little bits of rubber with holograms for $60. They're all just rubber with holograms in them. But every company got onto the act, after Power Balance was successful. But the thing was, largely due to the efforts of skeptics and going through consumer affairs and getting onto the media, the Power Balance franchise in Australia actually failed. It failed.
Is the company out of business in Australia now?
Yes. Yeah, the company in Australia is out of business. It's failed. The final nail in the coffin was government action, but the government action only came about because of skeptical activism. And once the government slapped restrictions on them and forced them to put up retractions saying that this thing does have no scientific evidence, in the words of the distributor, the sales just evaporated.
Mm. Which, of course, hasn't stopped them from flogging it elsewhere in the world. Without.
Oh, it's still going around elsewhere in the world. You can still buy these damn things in the United States.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, you can still buy knockoffs and copies and wannabes in this country because the government, and there's the latest one we're chasing at the moment.
Mm.
There we go. Now, where is the original power balance band said it used Schumann frequency energy? The latest fad is to have the same thing, the same things with holograms in them, but say they work on negative or positive ions.
Ooh, science-y.
Science.
Science.
Right,
that is a little more science-y.
And now it's actually Steve Novella who he wrote a great piece on science-based medicine, the blog, about this latest one, which the Australian skeptics are chasing at the moment, the NRG ion titanium band, and just made it very clear that the medical claims for this were just ridiculous. So here's a scoop for SGU. The Australian Skeptics on Monday will be publishing an open letter to this company and to the chain of shops selling this, basically saying, what are you doing? This, there's no backing, scientific, and we're quoting Steve Novella. So if that doesn't get action, I don't know what will.
Well, there was another one as well, Rebecca, called Ciora. C-I-E, and then Aura, A-U-R-A. I think it's been around the States before. But is that's it there?
That's the Ciora band.
It basically looks like a power balance band.
Yeah, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, except it's a bit fatter. These actually turned up on our, like the FDA list of drugs registered in America. We have a similar thing in Australia. This turned up on our official government listing of drugs last week. Somehow I managed to get through the system and got put on as an official medical device in Australia.
Well, hang on. When Rachie says somehow it made it through the system, we know that's because there's actually not much of a system. So,
right.
So it's not that hard for something to get onto the system making these sorts of claims in the first place.
Yeah, but when you asked about skeptical winds in that area, the good thing about this was our friend Loretta Marin, who's also known as the Jelly Bean Lady in Australia, she contacted the government department and said, what the hell is this doing on your list of medical devices? It's a bit of rubber, and also it's the same as Power Balance, which was slapped down and, you know, kicked out of Australia last year or this year, and they removed it. They took it off straight away. So it was on there for about a week and now it's gone again.
Mm.
So that's another thing that but the problem is it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole. You know, you've got to find the products yourself and you've got to then go and make a complaint about them. And then as soon as you whack one down, another one pops up. That's trouble because the government here is pretty slack in that.
Yeah, we do a lot of the groundwork which the government should have done before these products hit the shelf. And I'll tell you something interesting about the Ciora band, and why I have it is because our good friends at Skeptical Bros, the guys who make the fantastic placebo band, and I happen to have a few placebo bands here, they cost something like 10 cents each in China to make, right? Now, one day they receive their order of placebo bands, which they sell quite legitimately, and the profits go to vaccination research. And
autism.
Good causes. In the box of placebo bands, accidentally from the same factory, was a Ciora band.
Oh, man.
Wow.
So, Richard, I want to clarify that. Are any of these manufacturers the same company, just the same header company, like selling two different products?
Quite possibly, you know, Jay, I don't know enough about it, but what I do know from this experience is that there are factories in China which are just doing a business. They get an order from a company saying, please make a band with this hologram to this design, and they just churn them out. And like I say, they cost about 10 cents each to make, and they sell anywhere in this country from $50 to $60. Although, I must admit, there's a chain in this country called the Reject Shop, which sells fun, cheap things from China and bits and pieces, and they were selling this recently.
Ooh, mystical.
Oh, the mystic band.
For $3, it's the same thing, probably from the same factory. It's got a yin yang sign on it.
And I like how they don't even bother to make any claims at all. They're just like, it's a piece of rubber.
They just let it hang out right out there.
Well,
I can't remember where the power balance we're using the sports people to promote it in the same way, but the energy band is being heavily, heavily promoted by a lot of our football players, and I just find it absolutely hilarious how they've got together a whole lot of different sportsmen, all from different teams playing the same sports, who are all claiming that it gives them a competitive advantage, but if they're all wearing them, really, what's the point?
Well, it's like steroids. Once one person takes them, everyone else has to keep up.
Yes, exactly. There you go. Mm-hmm. But what's funny too is that some of the same sportsmen who are promoting this thing, the NRG, formerly promoting Power Balance. Hey, Steve Novella.
Hey, guys. All right. Well, have you guys talked about those new titanium
bands? We just got to it.
Yeah.
You did.
Yeah, we're discussing the issue in general, and we've discussed the all the different types you can get, and I have been showing this one. But, Steve, since you know more about this, the medical side, the medical claims, than us, because of your expertise. You wrote a fantastic thing on the science-based medicine about the so-called evidence that these people were putting up.
These titanium bands that are currently being are sold are extremely similar to the power bands that you guys took on previously.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're essentially magic amulets. There was also advertised recently these golf shirts that have kind of energy fibers woven into them. But again, it's basically, you could just make up anything. It's essentially the same thing, just using some kind of hand-waving, science-y sounding explanation to argue that these products do what is easy to claim for them, you know, that they will improve performance, because that's something that is very open to suggestibility. Just if you suggest to somebody that no matter what you do, that they will perform a little bit better at some sport, it's easy to convince themselves that in fact that's happening. So it's exploiting that phenomenon of the suggestibility of people.
Absolutely, and of course it's backed up with science that most people don't understand, so they simply assume, like we all would, a lot of people would, that what they're being told is correct, because it's science that they can't grasp, and it's the old thing that we've been programmed to believe authority.
And in fact, a quote from one of the football players who's using it was, he said, "For me, I think it's beneficial. I don't know if it is something in my head, but as an athlete, you're always looking for something different. Even if it's just a psychological edge, it's worth it." So they don't actually particularly care whether it works or not.
They
whether they understand how it works
Thanks so much, guys. This has been a fun talk. We're really glad Australia weighed in on our 24-hour show.
We've had heaps of fun. Thanks.
Thanks for having us along, and well, please visit www.skepticzonetv. Our latest episode just online is a Michael Shermer special. Ooh. So there you go.
Ooh. Yeah, awesome. All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Are you guys ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
All right. Here we go. Item number one, a newly published review of the most frequently viewed YouTube videos claiming to depict a patient suffering from a movement disorder found that 2/3 of the videos actually showed individuals with a psychogenic disorder. Item number two, a new study shows that women's voices are higher during ovulation and harsher and more irregular during menstruation. Item number three, new evidence indicates that some small feathered dinosaurs survived for millions of years after the mass extinction that wiped out their cousins. So, Bob, on this one, you were going to go first.
Okay. YouTube videos. Oh, yeah, I remember that. That reminds me of that one video of that girl that What was the condition that she said that she had?
Oh, no, the,
and
yeah.
It, and it also, afterwards, she was also speaking in an English accent. It was another side effect of her condition.
The cheerleader.
So, YouTube videos of people supposedly suffering movement disorder found that in 2/3, they actually showed individuals with a psychogenic disorder, meaning it's all in their head, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds reasonable to me, that most of them would just be people who aren't qualified to know what they're suffering from. So, I don't have too much of a problem with that one. Let's see. Women's voices are higher during ovulation and harsher and more irregular during menstruation. Voices are higher. Oh, wow. Interesting. New evidence indicates that some small feathered dinosaurs survived for millions of years after the mass extinction. Wouldn't some feathered dinosaurs have to survive? The ones that evolved into modern-day birds?
All right. Obviously, I'm not referring to birds. I'm referring to feathered dinosaurs.
Well, yeah, but they became birds. They evolved into birds, right?
Yeah, right.
So some would have to survive.
So the simplest way to clarify that is feathered but still non-avian dinosaurs.
All right, I guess I could. I can kind of still buy that, especially if they were small. Lots of small animals and mammals survive that. So yeah, if they were big, then I'd have much more of a problem with it. So for some reason, yeah, the first one makes sense, and I can make sense of the dinosaur one. So yeah, the second one, that leaves the second one. I don't necessarily can infer the from what I know, but I'm going to say that the woman's voices during ovulation, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay?
All right, so the first one about the 2/3 of the videos actually showed people that had psychogenic disorder. I mean, I don't know about what percentage. I definitely know that a portion of those people have psychogenic disorders, so I'll agree with that one, absolutely. Number two, the study showing that women's voices are higher during ovulation and harsher and more irregular during menstruation. That, you know, on a very, very uneducated surfacey level, yeah, that seems to make sense. I mean, when they're going through menstruation, a lot of women are in pain and whatnot and all that. That seems to make sense from like a completely unskilled place, and I certainly have not read that. So I'll go with that one. I kind of agree with Bob about the one with the feathers. I like what Bob said. Like, wouldn't some of them have to survive in order for us to eventually have birds that, you know, have feathers, and that's where the feathers came from? I'm going to take the one about the feathers as being wrong.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm kind of kicking myself right now because that one rings a bell. And I think I even tweeted an article about, I don't know if it's where this came from or not. Yeah, you know, okay, so 2/3 of videos showing individuals with psychogenetic disorder. I mean, how many videos are there? And were they all of that same one woman that we all are familiar with? I mean, presumably they evaluated the most viewed videos, like one per individual, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. I just can't imagine that there were that many out there.
You're talking about YouTube.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I find that
kind of sad. They got like 5,000 videos? I mean, come on.
Easily. But okay. I mean, that's a very high number, but I can believe it. And I can also believe that women's voices change depending upon their cycle. A lot changes. So yeah, sure. So the feathered dinosaur thing, surviving for millions of years, that one just strikes me as there being something a bit off about it. So I think I'm going to go with Jay on this one and say that that's the fiction.
Wow. Okay, Evan?
2/3 of the video actually showed individuals with a psychogenic disorder. That'll be pretty surprising if it's true, I think. That surprised me. I'm tending to think that one's fiction. And then you study that women's voices are higher and more irregular during menstruation. How exactly do they measure that? So they slap recorders on women. Number two, women fiction. Same as Bob.
Okay. Let's see. Bob and Evan believe that the menstruation one is fiction. Jay and Rebecca believe that the feathered dinosaur one is fiction. So that means you all believe that a newly published review of most frequently viewed YouTube videos actually depicts psychogenic disorder. And that one is science.
Oh.
All so, so good so far. So yeah, I mean, this obviously caught my attention because I wrote a number of blog articles about the cheerleader. Remember the Redskins cheerleader?
Desiree Jennings,
who believed that she had a movement disorder, specifically dystonia, when in fact she's now actually a textbook case of a psychogenic.
So she wasn't faking?
No, I think she did not have insight into what was going on. But that's what psychogenic means. I mean, it's an actual disorder. You believe that there's a problem, but it's just a different part of the brain that's
even
not
though she was
yet.
Caught, you know, not speaking in an accent without knowing cameras.
Yeah, but
were
you
on
could say that it comes
on.
And goes. It's triggered by stress. You know,
yeah.
So you could rationalize it a lot
fishy.
Of ways.
That's
yeah, you can never tell. You know, and then I don't think that the insight versus no insight is a black or white, you know, false dichotomy. I think it's people could really believe they're sick, but then may embellish it in order to convince the doctors that it's real. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But do you think it's possible, though, that maybe it started out as something that she thought was real and then she just kept going because she got embarrassed, almost to validate what had happened before?
That's possibility as well. A possibility as well. But interestingly, you're reviewing, you know, hundreds of YouTube videos with people who believe that they have one movement disorder or another. Sometimes it's Parkinson's disease or dystonia. Two-thirds of them, when reviewed by neurologists who can diagnose them, saw that they actually had psychogenic disorder.
But these are neurologists who are diagnosing it just based on the YouTube video?
Yes. That's correct.
How accurate can that be?
Very. Because movement disorders are diagnosed by the nature of the movement, and it is something that you can diagnose with a video alone. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are things you can do when you directly physically examine somebody that gives you added information, but there's only so many different ways that the different subsystems in the brain can malfunction and produce abnormal movements. So if it's not one of those, you know, then... You know, then to think, well, then this is a bit of an argument from ignorance, but then it's something else. It's psychogenic. Because again, unless you think there's some unknown mystery movement system in the brain. But also, it's not just that. There are some positive features of a psychogenic disorder that we could say, ah, see, that's actually a characteristic that correlates with a psychogenic disorder. For example, subjects may think that they have poor balance, but then when you examine their gait, their walking, they actually do things that require a great deal of balance.
Like wobble and catch
wobble
themselves.
And catch themselves, which yeah makes it oh I have poor balance, but doing that actually requires a lot of balance. If you actually had a balance disorder, you would fall. You would not be able to catch yourself.
That reminds me of a video I saw of President Ford, because he was known to be he was caught on camera stumbling a lot, and I remember mm-hmm. they dissected one video where he was stumbling down the steps of a plane, and if you watched it closely, some guy was saying, you know, he really recovered so well. That he's not really a klutz. He's just you know unlucky when it comes to that, and he was really quite adroit, I guess.
Right.
But Steve, I mean, how much of a surprise is this? I mean, if I had a movement disorder, I would really not be depending on YouTube to learn that much about it. I mean, I'd go to some really reputable sites.
That was the point, is that people shouldn't be relying upon YouTube to diagnose themselves. Maybe this was a chain reaction. Somebody
is that
sees.
What they're doing, though? Or are they just putting videos up?
No, I think the people who are putting videos up of themselves, who knows why they're doing that? Maybe there's a self-selective process going on there. Why would you want to advertise your movement disorder to the world? But the point of the article was to warn people who are just go looking for medical information. Think, oh, I wonder what Parkinsonism looks like.
Yeah.
Well, don't rely on YouTube if you're trying to figure that out, because most of the ones there, they're self-diagnosed and they're self-misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on to the second one. A new study shows that women's voices are higher during ovulation and harsher and more irregular during menstruation. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction. Jay and Rebecca think this one is science.
All right.
And this one is science.
Wow.
This one is science. Now, interestingly, the study showed...
Oh, wait, no.
Jay.
It was
Jay.
Rebecca and Jay.
He just said it. He just said it.
It was habit. It was habit.
I don't blame
muscle
you.
Muscle memory? Bob.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
That was the worst high five ever.
The worst high five ever.
Stand up. There you go.
No.
All right. So, interestingly, The study, if you just read the headline of the study, it sounds negative, because the study showed that men cannot reliably detect when a woman is ovulating by her voice, but it did find statistically that women's voices are higher during ovulation, which is supposed to be more alluring, but men couldn't detect that.
Yeah.
But it is true. Machines could detect it. You could measure it as being higher. And at the same time, women's voices are more variable and harsher when they're menstruating for whatever reason. So that was true, but it does make it sound like it was negative, because the study was also looking at could men detect that difference. Which means new evidence indicates that some small feathered dinosaurs survived for millions of years after the mass extinction that wiped out their cousins is the fiction, because what the research showed is that they went extinct at exactly the same time. So the same meteorite that caused dinosaurs to go extinct 65 million years ago also essentially wiped out ancient birds, a team of paleontologists claim in a new study. So essentially any primitive or ancient bird was also wiped out.
That is the article I retweeted, so I'm glad that I...
You remembered it correctly?
Well, I really only retweeted it to make a really bad early bird joke about how it's better just to stay in bed, because otherwise you'll get wiped out.
The early bird got wiped out by the asteroid?
Right. Exactly.
Right. If it really was an asteroid that wiped
it out. It's a terrible joke, and I don't think anybody got it anyway. But at least it helped me here.
It was a good try. It was a good try.
Well, that was a few highlights from our 24-hour show. I'd like to thank everybody who participated in the show, not only the Rogues, Jay, Bob, Evan, and Rebecca, but also our crew. We had a large crew helping us with all the technical aspects, Mike Lassell, Adam Isaac, Doug Soban, Brian Trent, Courtney Bergen, and Ed Povilaitis. So thank you guys for all of your help and support during the 24 hours. I'd also like to thank all of the guests who appeared on the show, who were willing to put up with the strange hours and the technical aspects of doing it. For those who are interested, we are planning on putting together an enhanced and edited version of the entire 24-hour show. It'll probably take us a little while to do the post-production on that to get that up, but we'll let you know as soon as that is available. So that is it for this week, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.